Good afternoon. Welcome back. We're going to get started with part two with Dr. Joseph Farrell.
Okay, now for the really bad news. So what was the bell? Whoops. Where are we here? What happened? Did I press the wrong button or did we lose it? Hello. All right, there we go. Skipped one on us, I guess. There we go. We're good. So what was the bell? Briefly, I believe the bell story to be the true basis, the ultimate basis, as it were, behind the Nazi UFO flying saucer legend. And again, these are the points I'll be talking about during this part of the presentation, just to kind of give you a heads up for those of you taking notes so that you can kind of follow along if you're following the outline in your notes. All right, let's talk about bell basics. Obviously, it's shaped like a bell. The Germans called it die Glocke, the bell. It stands roughly 15 to 18 feet tall, about 12 to 15 feet wide. It's cylindrical shaped like a bell. Its configuration is such that on the inside, there are two counter-rotating drums, which, unlike Nick Cook and Igor Vitkovsky, I believe were stacked one on top of the other. Inside of these cylinders, on the interior surface as they're being spun up, and in the actual center of the bell device, the Germans would put a fluid that they had codenamed IRR Serum 525. Now, this is described as having been of reddish maroon color, and I'll mention who's doing the describing here in a moment, of reddish maroon color, of very heavy density, of heavy weight, and we don't really know the ingredients of it, but I suspect that since it's a liquid, probably mercury is involved, some isotope of mercury, and I also suspect that they were using thorium-229 isomer, and I'll explain why. An isomer is simply a radioactive isotope whose nucleus is in an extremely high state of spin. And when it slows down from that high state of spin, it releases an enormous burst of gamma rays. Okay? Now, thorium-229 isomer just happens to be one of those isomers whose excitation threshold is very low. In other words, it's very easy to get it to slow down and release all these gamma ray bursts, okay? The bell was also cryogenically cooled by either liquid nitrogen or liquid oxygen. There's a little bit of variance in the story, but the common element is that it was cooled down to an extremely low temperature. And again, if you know anything about the recent experiments in superconductivity, you'll recall that most of it is at a very, very low temperature, and it again involves this high state of spin. So in other words, look what we have. We have two counter-rotating drums, which incidentally are spinning mechanically at a very high rate of spin. We're using a serum that is probably a compound of mercury and perhaps thorium-229 isomer. We're cryogenically cooling it. Now there's another little element that's very important here, and that's the sound that it makes. The Germans also kind of nicknamed this device Der Bienenstock, the beehive. And the reason I think it's making these sounds, and again, I outline a more detailed case in my books, but basically, the Germans are using two kinds of electrical potential, alternating current and extremely high voltage direct current. And it's being pulsed. There's a direct current switch that's being opened and closed extremely fast, so it gives off that characteristic buzzing sound that you hear associated with direct current electricity. Now, here's an important point to bear in mind, is the observed effects. When they tested the bell on plants, plants were seen to decay within a matter of hours to weeks to a mere kind of brownish gray goo. And they did so without putrefaction. They just literally fell apart. When it was tested for the first time in the presence of humans, 7 of the scientists themselves that were involved with the project died. Subsequently, when tested in the presence of human beings, including concentration camp victims, but even some of the German technical personnel themselves, they would report having experiences of vertigo, of sensations on their skin, of little needles prickling their skin. They would have a metallic taste in their mouths, which is an effect, incidentally, that I actually read a similar thing in one of Timothy Good's books, which kind of interested me, because you have kind of the same effect being described by this device. Some of the concentration camp victims from the camp of Gross Rosen that were involved with this project observed at night what they describe as barrel-like devices ascending above the tree lines where the bell was being tested, ascending above the tree lines with a kind of a pale blue glow, and then it would settle slowly back down under the tree line. So in other words, one of the observed effects of this device was precisely levitation, or if you prefer, anti-gravity. But please note something here. I'm stressing these effects because obviously it's deadly to humans. So we have here a prototype technology, and I'll show you in a moment why I think the Germans took it so far, but so far only. We have here a kind of a prototype technology in field propulsion, but it's not yet a practical flying craft, okay? Because they do not really know how to control these effects on organic matter. Now, the next interesting thing about the bell, I'm just kind of giving you the data points, and we'll see what it all sums up to in a moment. It was tested partly underground and then partly above ground. But when it was tested underground, it was tested in a deep mine, in a cavern, a chamber that was made specially for the purpose, in a deep mine underground. This chamber was lined with ceramic bricks. And over these ceramic bricks, they had to place rubber mats. And after each test of the device, these rubber mats had to be removed and burned, and then the entire place had to be scrubbed down with brine. And that was a task that usually fell to the concentration camp inmates, again, indicating that there was some risk involved in that procedure. Now, here's an interesting clue, and this is the reason why I think that this device was using high voltage direct current in addition to alternating current, and that is that the Germans specially built an entire electrical power plant at the facility that the bell was being tested at. Now, there's absolutely no reason for them to do so if all they're using is alternating current, because, of course, you can step it up at transforming stations from wherever your power source is. And, of course, this means, you know the old Edison problem, Edison and his direct current electricity plan for the United States, that basically would have had us ending up with a power plant about every 2 or 3 miles. You know, it would have been an environmental disaster. Unfortunately, Nikola Tesla saved us from that. But This is the indicator that we're dealing here most likely with something that required enormous amounts of high voltage direct current electricity, because that falls off. The further you get away from the power source, the amount of power available to you falls off very quickly and dramatically. So it had to be built very close to the facility. And that indicates also that they could not get the power levels simply from large amounts of capacitors or batteries. The location where the bell is tested is in a little town called Ludwigsdorf in Lower Silesia, which is a part of Germany. If you remember the pre-war maps of Germany, it's that little part, kind of a finger, that stuck down between Poland and Czechoslovakia. That's Silesia. The town is now called Ludwikowice in Poland. Now, this is the headquarters for where it's tested. This is Schloss Fürstenstein in the same region of Silesia. This is a photo courtesy of my friend Igor Witkowski, who's actually the fellow that broke the story of the bell, by the way. And you'll notice around here that there's lots of trees. It's very hilly, very rugged. And underneath this castle, the SS had built a veritable rat's run of tunnels and galleries and chambers and so on. So in other words, this whole area under here is just honeycombed with secret underground installations. And there's also a mine that is part of this whole facility. Now here's a real interesting thing. I call this the hinge. Nick Cook and Igor Witkowski call it the flytrap, or whatever you want to call it. This structure is, I'd say, maybe 800 to 900 yards from the power plant. It's about 30 feet tall, maybe about 50 feet wide at the top. Underneath this structure, it sits in a basin or pool about 4 feet deep. And out here to either side, around the structure, on the ground, is heavy concrete with ports all the way around the structure, ports for heavy-duty electrical cabling that ran into the structure from the ground. Now, there's some people recently that have started arguing that this structure was nothing but a structure for a cooling tower for a reactor. And my response is that no structure like a cooling tower requires heavy-duty direct current electrical cabling. No cooling tower sits in a basin or pool. And finally, this structure itself here has been measured recently with high amounts of radioactivity. And again, go back to the serum and the heavy-duty gamma ray emissions. This looks to me like it was the test rig for its outdoor testing, where people were seeing things ascending, barrel-like devices ascending and glowing a pale blue glow, which of course is an electrical signature of some pretty heavy voltage and ionization taking place in the atmosphere. Now there's another bit of data point I want to bring to your attention, and there are two personnel, interesting people, connected with the bell, and this bit of information I have just found out very recently, so you're some of the first people to hear this. Hubertus Strugholt was one of the medical doctors involved with the project precisely at that castle that I showed you earlier, where there were underground facilities that he was apparently involved in testing how to limit the effects of this device on human beings. So in other words, again, this is a signal that we're still dealing with a prototype technology. It's very advanced, but still it's in a kind of a prototype stage. We're not at the stage of something practically usable as a flyable craft. But interestingly enough, this same Dr. Strugholt ends up in this country as a paperclip scientist working in space medicine for NASA. Okay? Now here is a really interesting fellow, yeah? This is Dr. Kurt Davis, standing next to his good friend Dr. Werner von Braun at NASA. Dr. Davis was a senior flight administrator for NASA at Cape Canaveral during the Apollo missions. Now, here's the interesting thing about him. This man here is the very same man who designed the power plant for the Bell. His specialty is not even rocket science at all. It's high voltage, heavy duty, direct current voltage and measurement. Ask yourself this question. What is this man doing as a senior flight director during Apollo at Cape Canaveral? I ain't going to tell you. That's a little bit of commercial. This guy is a really interesting character. This is SS Obergruppenführer Emil Matzev, basically a four-star general. Now, folks, I'm one of those people who's kind of a World War II buff. There's not many names in the German, American, or British, or French, or Russian officer corps that are unfamiliar to me. But I can assure you that after almost literally my whole life reading about World War II, I have never, ever, to this day, found anything about this man other than his file is still classified, and he was the head of one of the departments that oversaw the Bell. And the department is precisely this thing, Forschung, Entwicklung und Patente, research, development, and patents. The mission brief of this department of the SS, it was classified almost at the pinnacle of the Third Reich's classification system. The mission brief of this department of the SS was literally to scour all patent applications within the Third Reich and later occupied Europe, of course, and pull any patent from public view that had national security implications and turn it over to another department of the SS to develop. Now, that other department was an SS department called SS Entwicklungsstelle 4, SS Development Area 4. And the mission brief of that department of the SS, again, top secret, was to investigate free energy to make Germany independent of foreign energy sources. Now, I'm emphasizing this point because at the very conclusion of this presentation, I'm going to show you what's going on here, what the implications politically and financially of all of this is. It's very contemporary. The actual overseer of all of the secret weapons projects inside the Third Reich, including the Bell, the administrator, so to speak, is this man that I mentioned in the first part, SS Obergruppenführer Hans Kammler. This is his SS identification photograph, in fact. Now, this man headed a group called the Kammlerstab, the Kammler group, or the Kammler staff. And I want to talk about this man's resume. He's just a love. This is the man that designed Auschwitz. So you see, there's your connection between secret weapons and the camps. This man was also the head of the SS Building and Works Department. In other words, he supervised all construction that the SS was undertaking. That meant, practically speaking, that he could call upon a slave labor pool of about 14 million people or victims. The mission brief of the Commerce Stop is very interesting. The mission brief was that it would brainstorm the necessary technology tree to second and third and fourth generation weapons systems and begin the groundwork practical research to bring each of them to fruition. As such, Commler essentially established a think tank, and it was headquartered inside the engineering division of the old Austro-Hungarian Imperial Munitions Works, the Skoda Works, in Pilsen, Czechoslovakia, about 30 miles west of Prague. Now, Commler, when he set up this think tank, freed all participants from any ideological adherence to Nazism and what it dictated for science. In other words, you were free to think absolutely outside the box, including the party prescribed box. And he went further. He not only recruited top scientists from inside the Third Reich and later occupied Europe, but he started a top secret science magazine. Isn't that cool? So that each scientist could circulate their top secret papers and keep abreast of each other. Now that, you think, is quite a breach of security. Wrong. Because, remember our friend from part one, Heinrich Gestapo Müller? The security for the Commerce Stop was under the personal control of Heinrich Müller, who had created a triple belt of security around this staff, this group of political and economic and industrial counterintelligence. In fact, the Commler group was never successfully penetrated by Allied or Soviet intelligence. We knew there was something in Czechoslovakia, but we didn't know the extent of it. And I emphasize something here. Hans Commler was the head, once more, of all jets, infrared sights, computers, phased array radars, radar absorbing material, television guided missiles, wind cannon, lasers, atomic bombs, hydrogen bombs, fuel air bombs, Bell, everything. This was a very powerful man. And given the extent of the research that his department is conducting, and given the extent of his access to SS plunder and slave labor, this man is in charge of a mega Manhattan project. Now you recall the other fellow from our unholy trinity was this man here, Heinrich Gestapo Müller, actual head of the Gestapo. He was a close and personal friend. Oops, seem to have lost my... Did it disappear over here? Where did we go? Well, behind? I can't see anything. Is it there? There, we got it. Okay, my bad. I found it. Thank you. Heinrich Müller was a personal friend of this man here, Martin Bormann. Remember him? Dick Cheney without the warmth and charm. Just a love. Now, the reason Müller and Bormann were friends is rather interesting. When Hitler was in one of his early political campaigns, his first mistress was his niece, Gaily Raubel. And she was found suspiciously dead of a suicide, and it appeared that it was Hitler's pistol that did the deed. And so Hitler went to his fixer, Martin Bormann, and Bormann said, "Don't worry, I'll take care of it." Bormann went to his friend, Heinrich Miller, who at the time was a Munich chief detective, in charge of the investigation, and said, "Cover up some of this, would you?" And of course, Heinrich Miller said, "Sure," and later is rewarded with being the head of counterintelligence of Nazi Germany in charge of the Gestapo. So isn't that interesting? Bormann has something on Hitler. Miller has something on Bormann. They're all SS four-star generals, and they're acquainted with Hans Kammler. There's your unholy trinity: finance, security, advanced research projects. Now, what were the Nazis hoping to do with this Bell device? I believe that they were investigating hyperdimensional physics, and that their reasons or motivations for doing so were depending on three things: a theoretical component that was in the physics literature in Germany between the wars, an engineering component. I mean, you can have all the fancy theory that you want, but it may not be engineerable. So is this stuff engineerable? Can you make something practical with it? And then finally, interestingly enough, the esoteric component, or if you will, the occult. Now, the theoretical and purely scientific component comes from this fellow. His name is Dr. Theodor Franz Eduard Kaluza. Some of you may have heard Michio Kaku on Coast to Coast, and every now and then he'll be talking about the run-up to string theory, and he'll mention this fellow, Kaluza, or Kaluza Klein. This is the fellow that formulates the first post-relativity unified field theory, unifying gravity and electromagnetism. And he does so in a theory that involves five dimensions, one of time, four of space. And that extra fourth spatial dimension is kind of a very tiny, curled up dimension that makes his geometry, the geometry of his theory, a cylinder. There's your stacked cylinders in the Bell, okay? That's the theory. And incidentally, he's not Jewish. Very important. This man stays in Nazi Germany during the war, okay? The really important component is this man, the engineering component. This fellow is probably unknown to most of you. His name is Gabriel Krohn. He is Jewish. He was a Hungarian Jew. He was a genius. He came to this country sometime during the 1930s. But in 1935, Gabriel Krohn, he's an electrical engineer, publishes a paper that wins him a prize, the Montefiore Prize, at the University of Liège in Belgium. And in the paper, what he is arguing is that all of these unified field theories that begin to come out in Germany, beginning with Theodor Kaluza, up to and including the early theories of Albert Einstein, what he says is that these theories are the hyperdimensional theories that can explain electrical anomalies that we electrical engineers observe in large, networked, rotating electrical systems. Now, please understand that what he has just told you is that these theories are engineerable practically on the laboratory bench. And remember what Einstein's theory was, which is a component. Relativity theory is a component of these unified field theories. When you say that these theories are practically engineerable on the laboratory bench with 1935 technology, you are saying that space-time itself is locally engineerable. And over the border in Nazi Germany, at that moment, publication of unified field theories inside the Third Reich stops. And the principal component of what he is observing as an engineer and saying, I can explain this with these hyperdimensional theories, is torsion. What's torsion? Well, for the mathematical out there, torsion, as you know, Einstein-Cartan torsion tensor, very small effect, usually negligible, you don't pay attention to it. There's another version called Ricci, dynamic torsion, but let's not argue mathematics, let's get down to brass tacks. What is the concept? Think of yourself as holding an empty soda can, and you wring it like a dish rag. There's your counter-rotating metal drums, folks, in the bell. Opposite ringing motion. The can represents space-time. As you wring it, you fold and pleat the fabric of the can, and the ends of the can draw nearer to each other. That's torsion. That's those two counter-rotating drums, all that high-spin fuel in the bell. Now, what's the significance of what Krohn said? Well, I've just told you, but historically, this is the period that you see unified field theory publications disappear inside the Third Reich. Krohn himself ends up in the United States working for General Electric. I think you all know of a famous experiment on a ship involving electricity and rotating fields. This is the third element in Nazi thinking. If you can believe or imagine Heinrich Himmler having a Rasputin, this is the man. And actually, that's his nickname, Himmler's Rasputin. This is Karl Maria Villigut, also known as Weisstor, also known as Jarl Vidar. He's a one-star SS general. He is on Himmler's personal staff. And the man is Himmler's personal occult expert. This guy was a well-known European esotericist, published many things, many articles about astrology, about ancient texts, about ancient, you know, space races, and so on and so forth. But here is his basic cosmology. What do we have? We have two counter-rotating spirals. Now, what does he say about this? Listen carefully. If you take nothing away from my presentation or my books, take this away, please. Behind many metaphysical texts, if you know the requisite physics, most of those texts can be decoded in terms of modern physics. And I would include many ancient Neoplatonic and Hermetic texts in that category. Villigut says this about those counter-rotating spirals, and I'll read it. You can follow along here on the left-hand side. Primal law. Above as below, below as above. Therefore, in the middle, there is a neutral force, idem est, generational field, from the two spirals. Each triply wound and connected by the generational plane, the middle field is developed to the world egg, unquote. Sounds kind of like an alchemist on LSD, okay? But look what it means. Decode it. The fabric of space-time, remember Krohn as you listen to this, the fabric of space-time is not a mere void. Space-time is itself an information-creating field that creates precisely by creating systems of rotation within systems of rotation within systems of rotation. Many of you have probably heard Richard Hoagland. He'll tell you, what are the three laws of hyperdimensional physics? Rotation, rotation, rotation. What do we have in the bell? Counter-rotating drums, high-spin nuclear isomers, spinning electricity, pulsed direct current electricity. And the symbol of all of this rotational physics has been staring us in the face since 1933, if not before. The corporate logo of the Nazi Party. And for those of you with a mathematical or physics background, now think of this as a vector diagram. Because what do you have? A subsystem of vectors, the outer arms of the swastika, a system of rotation. And the inner arms of the swastika representing a system of stress, rotation and stress, in the medium itself, ringing the can with counter-rotation. So in other words, in a certain sense, given the fact that all of these top secret SS departments were set up almost at the inception of the Nazi regime, you have a nation state that was dedicated to the principle of exploring the modern scientific applications of ancient lore and making it practically engineerable. That's why you have all the explosion of this technology that you do, because they were thinking utterly outside the conventional box. So the purpose of the Bell Project then was, in my opinion, to explore the theory and technology of creation itself. In other words, of the godlike ability to manipulate or engineer the fabric of space-time itself by tapping into the dynamic characteristics of space-time, its rotational characteristics. Now, please note the implication. Such a technology, if successful, would obviously lead, number one, to so-called free energy and a complete and utter end to a dependence on petrodollars, limited non-renewable energy resources, and, for the Nazis, Anglo-American corporate financial predators. In other words, the very people that put the Nazis into power, the Nazis are no longer playing the New World Order game ballgame from the get-go. Number two, obviously, given the testimony of people involved with the Bell Project in the camps that see this thing levitating, it leads to an anti-gravity field propulsion physics. But here's the real thing. This is what the Nazis are really after. Because its classification, again, is the only project in Nazi Germany to have the classification of Kriegsentscheidend, war decisive. Because if you weaponize this stuff, you have a potentially planet-busting technology that would make a hydrogen bomb look like a firecracker. And this is the technology that Martin Bormann kept to himself. Yeah? While he's giving away atomic bombs and rockets. I told you it was bad news. So what the bell was, is it's a prototype experimental technology. And I please understand, a prototype experimental technology to test the aspects of a torsion-based hyperdimensional unified field theory designed deliberately to lead them to free energy technologies, to field propulsion technologies, and ultimately to the ultimate planet-busting energy weapon whose destructive potential we can only imagine. What the bell wasn't, it is not a mere isotope centrifuge for enrichment. I've heard that one. But sit down and do the physics, people. It is not a mere plasma trap, although through its use of that serum 525 and rotating it and electrically stressing and pulsing it, yeah, plasma is definitely involved. It is not a Nazi UFO, because there aren't people flying this thing that are inside it. I wouldn't want to be. It was not a time machine used by the Nazis to time travel. Although, as we shall see and have seen with the plants decaying, there are time dilation effects involved. What are we doing? We're wringing that soda can. It is not a Stargate or dimensional portal, though again, the physics implied in it does imply some very extreme shear effects in the actual structure of space-time itself. So, might that possibly result? Yeah. Did the Nazis actually use it for that purpose? Probably not, because we're dealing with the prototype technology. Were they successful? Did they achieve their goal? Again, to a certain extent, yes. We've seen the effects on plants. We've seen the effects on humans. We've seen the observed levitation. And all those effects are commensurate and condign exactly to the type of physics I've been describing to you, this extreme shearing effect in the physical medium. And incidentally, the final clincher is that one of the Bell's project code names was Project Kronos, Project Time. So let's sum up the physics. The dimensions, I don't think, at this juncture and stage of my research, I don't think served any practical, functional purpose. The cryogenic cooling, yes, superconductivity, once again, high spin, high speed rotation. The counter-rotating of drums, again, torsion shear, high speed rotation. Serum 525, plasma, yes, torsion. What's the sun? It's a ball of plasma that's rotating. And incidentally, the layers of the sun don't all rotate at the same speed. Physicists call it differential rotation. So the sun gives itself off torsion effects. And that means, and I wrote a recent book that just came out about this, that means that the standard thermonuclear model of fusion in the sun is not all that's going on in it. There's something else dealing with the nature of time and rotation itself. Probable use of thorium in this substance. Why do I say thorium? Briefly. When the Allies went into Nazi Germany and sent their intelligence agents scattered throughout the Third Reich, one of the big mysteries we could not explain, it made no sense to us, that's how inside the box we were, that here's the Nazis, you know, we've got the A-bomb, but these Nazis, these stupid idiots, are stockpiling massive amounts of thorium. And what are they using it for? We've never been able to figure it out. Except thorium-229 isomer, to get enough of it to be of any use to you, number one, you have to have a very sophisticated technology to separate it. Laser enrichment. Number two, since it only exists in a few parts per million, you have to have a lot of thorium to isolate enough of this isomer to be of any use to you. Why the alternating and direct current potentials? Well, you spin up that serum in these counter-rotating drums mechanically and electrically. This is both quite important. And you use the drums themselves as one polarity in an electrical circuit, the center of the bell as the negative polarity, and then you pulse that plasma with an extremely high voltage direct current pulse. You've got all the atoms spinning in the same plane. You've got an isomer. You pulse it with high voltage electricity, de-excite that isomer, and as a result, you create a kind of a little space-time bubble around this device. There's your levitation. And as that happens, all that isomer spits out those gamma ray bursts that are so deadly to things in its field. So that's kind of the way I rationalize this device on the basis of the physics. Again, what's the purpose of all this? Well, look at what we're dealing with. We're dealing with a unified field theory. So we have a unified physics implying, therefore, a unified technology which is capable of being used in three different applications: free energy, field propulsion, and the ultimate weapon. Now you'll recall, before the break, I mentioned that Bormann turned over to Hans Kammler, whose headquarters is in Prague, the last German long-range heavy lift aircraft unit in the Luftwaffe, including one of these enormous Junkers 390 aircrafts. There's a picture of it. Imagine trying to hide that monster from snooping American or British counterintelligence agents. It's an enormous aircraft. Again, capable of flying nonstop from Germany to Argentina. Well, interestingly enough, Kammler himself does an amazing thing. I wish I could do it. He dies four times. All on different days and on different circumstances. In one version, he shoots himself. In another version, he orders his aide to shoot him. In yet another version, which has kind of two subversions, incidentally, he either shoots himself in a forest outside of Prague or takes poison. And in the last version, he goes down in a blaze of glory fighting rebelling Czechs. Okay? In other words, you're dealing exactly as you are with Martin Bormann, and exactly as you are with, incidentally, Adolf Hitler, with a story whose details are obfuscated and whose details have all been supplied to us by whom? Nazis. And the last Junkers 390 disappears after it flies from Prague to Norway and is never heard from again. It went to one of two places, according to Igor Witkowski and Nick Cook. It went to here, carrying Kammler and the Bell Project documentation. But I don't think so. This is the last picture of the Junkers 390 in Prague, incidentally, in April of 1945, being loaded up, made ready for a long-range trip. And you kind of get an idea of the enormous size of the aircraft. Where did it go? In my opinion, it went to Argentina because there's a little known project in Argentina in a heavily Germanized area of the country in in Rio Negro province around the little town of San Carlos de Bariloche. That's about 900 some miles southwest of Buenos Aires. So let's look now finally at the rodents at the other end of the rat lines. What do we need if we're going to have a post-war Nazi international extraterritorial state? Well, we first of all need a neutral country large enough and with enough wilderness or remote areas to safely house an advanced research project. Number two, even though it's wilderness, we have to have some accessibility to it if we're going to carry on any sort of advanced research. It's kind of like the Nazi version of Area 51. We have to have, thirdly, a government that is amenable to a large Nazi presence within its borders. Fourthly, that country must be technologically sophisticated enough to support whatever scientific research or projects this extraterritorial Nazi state wants to pursue, or at least be able to import it, in other words, have sufficient German business contacts to do so. There has to be sufficient territory within the country to hide the project. So, on this view, we have to rule out Europe. Because, for one thing, the Allies and the Soviets are going to be crawling all over Europe looking for Nazis. So you don't want to conduct any research there. Neutral countries in Europe, the same thing. There has to be a sufficient German business penetration into the country to permit easy transfer of funds into and out of it to support a research project that would require a lot of money. And finally, here's a good one. Since we know the Vatican was deeply involved in these rat line operations, the country has to have a sufficiently large Roman Catholic population base. And that leads us, of course, to Juan Perón and Argentina. Now, as a kid, I used to think, gee, why is Juan Perón, who is such a Nazi file? I mean, he thinks these guys are great, you know? It's kind of like people that think Dick Cheney's great, okay? He thinks these guys are wonderful. And yet, in March of 1945, and I used to puzzle over this, why is he doing this? In 1945, Juan Perón declares war on his best friends, Nazi Germany. What's he doing? Why? And why is he doing it so late? Well, here's Perón's answer from his memoirs. Listen to this carefully. We hadn't lost contact with Germany despite the break in diplomatic relations, Perón would say in 1967. Things being so, listen, we received an unusual request. Even though it may seem contradictory at first, Germany benefits from our declaration of war. If Argentina becomes a belligerent country, it has the right to enter Germany when the end arrives. This means that our planes and ships would be in a position to render a great service. At that point, we had the commercial planes of the Fama Line, the Argentine merchant air fleet, and the ships we had bought from Italy during the war. That is how a great number of people were able to come to Argentina. Close quote. Isn't that neat? They flew right in there, they picked up a bunch of Nazis, and flew them back to Buenos Aires and served them cocktail and peanuts as an ally of the United States, Great Britain, France, and the Soviet Union, and there was nothing we could do about it. So after he gets all these Nazis, what do they do? Well, in 1951, Perón tells us what they've done for him. He holds a press conference and he announces to the world that Argentina has successfully discovered the secret of the hydrogen bomb. Now, we haven't even exploded ours yet, okay? So needless to say, the scientific press in the world denounced this whole thing as a fraud. But at this press conference, he introduces a fellow by the name of Dr. Ronald Richter, who proceeds to tell the Argentine reporters, "Yes, I've learned how to control thermonuclear fusion." But, as we're going to see, Richter has some unusual ideas about plasmas, if this isn't sounding familiar by now. And as we're going to see, America expresses its profound disinterest in Dr. Richter, up to the point of drawing up a shopping list of things it is specifically disinterested in that we would really like to get. Okay? And we're going to finally talk about some odd metal drums. All right, so when Richter's introduced, as I've mentioned, this is a picture of him here with his little baby down in Argentina. When he's introduced by Perón at this 51 press conference, he says, "Yeah, I've learned how to control thermonuclear fusion." And, of course, he's roundly denounced by Time magazine, the New York Times, and so on and so forth. But his project is located, looky there, San Carlos de Bariloche, in that remote wilderness region of Argentina, 900 miles southwest of Buenos Aires, and he's doing all this fusion research there in a laboratory that Juan Perón built for him, okay? Now he says, look, this is what he's doing with his plasma fusion research. He says, okay, I'm inducing shock waves with high electrical stress in a magnetically rotated plasma. Is that sounding familiar? Yeah. That's the bell. He's not doing thermonuclear fusion research at all. But that's what he's telling Perón. Well, when the press in the world denounces Richter as a fraud, Perón appoints a commission to investigate Richter and his claims. So the Argentine scientist traipses off 900 miles from Buenos Aires down to San Carlos de Bariloche, and when they get there, Richter acts like a total goofball because he performs all of his experiments for the Argentine scientists, but he does things like forgets to turn on his Geiger counters, places his measuring equipment behind the radioactive shielding where it will do him no good to take any measurements. And this happens over and over again. And not only that, he takes him to a heavy water factory and he says, "Yeah, we're producing heavy water here." And the Argentines say, "Well, how do you know this? How much are you producing?" And the response is, "Well, we don't really know because we haven't got any measuring equipment." So needless to say, Juan Perón has the project closed. But before he does so, he sends off to his friend, Prince Bernhard, and asks for Bernhard to send a Dutch physicist down to investigate the project. Now, who's Prince Bernhard? All heard of him? The Netherlands, yeah. Prince Bernhard, by the way, friends, is an SS officer and a vice president of IG Farben. File that away. We'll get back to it. Perón shuts the project down because his scientists assure him that Richter is not only a fraud, he's a nut. He doesn't know what he's doing. Richter's behavior is obviously incompetent. Placing measuring equipment where it'll do him no good, forgetting to turn it on time and time again, saying that he has no way of knowing whether he's producing heavy water or not. But 4 years after the event, the United States is still interested, quietly. And it asks Richter, who's still stuck in Argentina, to kind of explain what he's really up to. So here's what Richter tells them. because he's been totally disgraced in Argentina. The Argentines will have nothing to do with him. The Germans won't have anything to do with him anymore. So here's what Richter in desperation tells the Americans. Quote, "We assume that highly compressed electron gas or plasma becomes a detector for energy exchange with what we call zero point energy, or if you prefer, the fabric of space-time. Zero point energy derives from the exclusion principle, and a bunch of scientific stuff, okay? But in other words, go on a little later, he says that a compression proportional amount of zero point energy can be tapped by means of a magnetic field controlled exchange fluctuation between that compressed electron gas or your plasma and a sort of cell structure in space representing what we call zero point energy. By the way, folks, this is almost the first time that this phrase occurs in the literature. It seems even possible that the large amplitude fluctuation signals derive from a mechanism of energy conversion unknown to us. Plasma implosion analysis might turn out to become an approach to a completely new source of energy. And as I point out, to my knowledge, this is actually the first time that you hear the phrase zero point energy anywhere, to my knowledge. I'm not absolutely certain of that, it's just to my knowledge. So the U.S. Air Force gets involved. I reproduced this in my Nazi International book. And this is really a gas to me. It's really, you have to read it to really get the humor of this document, because the Air Force in this cover sheet here, number one, acknowledges the theoretical possibility of what Richter is trying to do, but says that it's technically unfeasible given the state of technology in the 1950s. But wait a minute. Didn't Gabriel Krohn say that this stuff was engineerable in 1935? Number two, it denounces Richter as a fraud, a mountebank, and a swindler, implying that the very same principles are fraudulent. Then number three, acknowledges that Argentina invested large amounts of money in that extremely secret project run by Richter, which implies that there's some validity to what he was doing. And number four, the project exploded with all the farce of an exploding soap bubble, implying that the same principles are fraudulent once again. And five, to be on the safe side, the U.S. Air Force will continue to collect and quietly evaluate as much data about Richter as it could. In other words, we really didn't have a clue, but we suspected that there was something else going on. But one U.S. Air Force scientist that I read in Richter's National Archives file said that the man was a mad genius working in the 1970s. So wait a minute. If we have a scientist working on the very same stuff as the Bell, which was a project begun in Nazi Germany and continued through the war, and it represents science that is being, at that time in the 1970s, that's ahead of the curve, folks. And then look at this one. The U.S. Air Force, as it looks through Richter's biography, runs across the fact that Richter had stumbled on to all of this weird stuff about plasmas in his research that he was conducting in 1936. We do know from Richter's file that he worked for the AEG company in Germany on plasma experiments under a project codenamed Charité Anlage, which, if you read under point number two, that's the exact code name of the power plant for the Bell. And the company that built that power plant was the AEG company. So in other words, Richter in Argentina is an independent Nazi Bell scientist. And incidentally, it was that same company that provided Richter with much of his equipment in Argentina. And if that's not enough for you, here's the whopper. This was a photograph taken by a friend of mine who goes down to Argentina, and he visits this kind of Nazi compound area there quite a lot, takes pictures and tours. This is his Argentine guide standing at the remains of one of Richter's laboratories on the island where he conducted his experiments. Look what he's standing next to. Large metal drums. Remember those two counter-rotating metal drums in the Bell? And if you ask the Argentines or even the Argentine scientists, they have no idea what these were for. None whatsoever. So we can conclude, and I outline all this again in my books that I list there, that since the Bell involved counter-rotating plasmas, since Richter's work in Argentina involves similar physics principles and the same company that supplied the power plant to the Bell and Richter's equipment, and since Richter worked on the same project that was the code name for the power plant of the Bell, and since Richter himself said that his real interest in plasmas isn't for plasmas for their own sake, but because they are a means or a gateway or a mechanism for tapping into the zero-point energy or the energy of space-time, yeah, the man is conducting the Bell. Ain't this interesting? This is kind of icing on the cake, folks. This is the end of the presentation, but this is kind of the icing. We've had the cake. Now we're looking at the icing. Look at the architecture in this region of Argentina. The German-style houses. Nice little Bavarian chalet in Rio Negro province of Argentina. I'm showing you these for a purpose. Here's an interesting hotel out in the middle of nowhere in Argentina. Here's the lobby of the hotel. Also, it's a story about this hotel. This hotel was built, prior to and during the war as a plastic surgery clinic. And? I forgot my monocle, but you get the idea. Since the end of the war, every year to this day, on April 20th, a group of veterans or their families or descendants gather to celebrate Adolf Hitler's birthday. In other words, my friends, all of this is still there. And my friend Harry Cooper tells me that the local Argentines there will tell you that in 1954, President Dwight Eisenhower visited this motel, which puts that military-industrial complex speech of his as he's leaving office into an interesting perspective, doesn't it? Because whose military-industrial complex did he have to fight? Whose military-industrial complex did we take over a lot of scientists from? So that, as my friend Richard Hoagland has pointed out in his book, his and Mike Barra's book, we're landing Apollo missions and surveyor missions on the moon on April 20th, on anniversaries of Adolf Hitler's birthday. And by the way, here's one that even my friend Richard missed. Apollo 11 landed on July 20th, 1969, the 25th anniversary of the failed bomb plot against Adolf Hitler. Remember that Bell scientist that's a senior flight director of Apollo, Kurt Davis? Why do I mention all of this about motels and plastic surgery? Well, the Police Gazette in 1964 ran this article by Harvey Wilson. I reproduce this in the book. I just kind of wanted you to see that there's an actual article here. But I kind of want to go to a close-up of it, because if you look carefully here, you'll see that the Nazis, according to the article, had established a compound within 100 miles of San Carlos de Bariloche in a place called the Estancia, the ranch, in an area of Argentina that they controlled that was an area of 10,000 square miles, roughly an area the size of the state of Massachusetts, okay, or I should say Commonwealth. And to get in and out of this compound, you had to have military-style passes. All security was headed by an SS captain. Why such a large area? Why such intense security? Well, you ask the local Argentines, and they'll tell you, because the ranch was headquarters and home to such noteworthies as Martin Bormann, Adolf and Eva Hitler themselves. And remember, that motel was built as a plastic surgery clinic. So what do we have? There's one final bit of evidence I want to leave you with before we kind of start summing up here, and that is this. This evidence indicates that there's some sort of post-war detente that was struck between this surviving extraterritorial Nazi state, this Nazi International as I call it, and the Anglo-American banking elite. Because remember, Bormann is sitting on a huge pile of cash that he has to launder. And the ones with the connections to do it are in London and New York. Think of families whose last names begin with R. Okay? But here's the bad news, David and Sir Edmund. When you're dealing with Martin Bormann, you're dealing with Dick Cheney without the warmth and charm. There's going to be a high price tag that comes with this money. And someday, that marker will come due. And they're researching the technology to pull the trigger. But this is neat. In 1967, Martin Bormann, according to CBS journalist Paul Manning, close associate, some of you may remember, Ed Murrow, okay? Wrote a book called Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, even ran it past Alan Dulles, who told him, and he mentions this in the foreword, who told Manning, yeah, you're on the right track. Manning uncovered this little tidbit. In 1967, Martin Bormann cashed a check for a considerable sum of money on Chase Manhattan and Manufacturers Hanover Trust, which cleared through Deutsche Bank in Buenos Aires, Argentina, and the check was written over his own signature. So what do we got? A remote, heavily guarded compound in Argentina, headed by SS security, plastic surgery clinic cum hotel, a post-war independent Nazi research project going on in Argentina, the probable presence in the area of Martin Bormann, and probably Heinrich Miller as well, and Hans Kammler. So what are the implications? And we'll have about 15 minutes here for questions, so if you want to kind of start lining up for questions as I wrap this up. I think there's a microphone over here somewhere. If you can see my laser, I don't know where it is over there. First implication. The ability to manipulate space-time, or to engineer it, that the Third Reich's Bell Project and this post-war Nazi fusion project in Argentina clearly imply that this whole area of research was continued after the war. But look what it promises. It's the same old SS Development Area 4 agenda to free Germany from the thumb of that Anglo-American corporate elite that actually put the Nazis into power. Because this physics promises an end to the current geopolitical order. The bad news is the Nazis were in there investigating it in a major way first. Secondly, it spells an end to the fiat debt currency system based on petrodollars in the hands of a private Anglo-American banking elite. But here's the real clincher. Remember Prince Bernhard, SS officer, vice president of IG Farben. Because the possibility exists, in my opinion, that the real purpose of the Bilderberger Group, since Bernhard was one of the founding driving forces behind it, and one of the early attendees was Dr. Hermann Josef Apps of Deutsche Bank. So I believe the real purpose originally was to facilitate the transfer of all this massive amount of Nazi money into those Western banks, which they could keep off the books and expand their ledger credit entry making ability. But as I said, if that's true, and you're playing with the likes of Martin Bormann and organized Nazis, eventually that marker will come due. And they are researching the physics to be able to pull the trigger if you don't want to pay when the time comes. That's a bad picture. So the implication is that that old detente, I read this current financial situation very differently than most people, because I read it that that old detente is breaking down and those old IOUs are coming due, and our Anglo-American corporate elite, led by those families whose last names begin with R, that panic that they're showing is partly genuine. They're acting like people under duress. And therefore, the current crisis may have something technologically, secretly driving it. So that's it. Thank you. Are you first? Yeah, there's about 12 minutes. I'm sorry, I ran a little over, but yes, ma'am.
Presentation was very good.
Thank you.
And I'm aware of that, what you said with the secret state there, what they created, let's call it that way, in Argentina, the Germans. Mm-hmm. But also, I think you forgot, they put an enormous amount of money and gold over by U-boats, submarines, I'm sorry, in English it's... submarines, enormous, which was all transferred. And I had a friend, he went over there to write a book, and he had made contacts first in Germany and then after the war, of course, and then he was taken, then he was said, yes, come. And he was blindfolded, and he was taken to certain locations, uh-huh, like that heavily guarded place.
Well,
there.
In answer to your question, I think I kind of get where you're going. I think that I'm aware of those U-boat transfers, and you know, there's so much of these Nazi enclaves in Latin America. Argentina was one sort of nerve center.
Yes.
But I have research, and I haven't published it in a book yet because I haven't got enough to indicate to me what was going on. But I have research, and there's a Latin American journalist that has recently even published a book about some of the things that Mengele was doing in Brazil. So Brazil is another hotbed of this post-war Nazi research that's going on. But I've told the story in five books. This is a big story, so I eventually plan to talk about some of this U-boat activity and so on, because it's a huge, huge story. If that was where you're going. We've got a lot of people, I can ask you to kind of keep it short, folks, so that more people can... Yes, ma'am.
Yeah, thanks for a fascinating presentation.
Thank you.
When you talked about the Germans using atomic material in conventional artillery shells in the East, I wonder if that we're seeing the first use of depleted uranium munitions.
Yeah, very good question.
And the second part is whether it was atomic material just used in a bomb way or if it was DU, there should be traces of it in those battlefields.
Right. There are indications that at the battlefields around Kursk, there are some high radioactive areas. But I haven't been able to substantiate that to my satisfaction, so that's why I say rumors. As for depleted uranium, that's an interesting thing, because I have heard persistent stories about the Nazis actually having used this in some of their anti-tank artillery and in their tanks. And the German 88 was bad enough, but make it worse with depleted uranium. that's very bad. But I think that if they had this technology, and I certainly think they did, then yes, it's a logical step for them to take this depleted uranium and use it in some practical military way. So I think that's an excellent insight.
Amazing research. Good job.
Thank you.
I could swear about a year or two ago I read in a newspaper that George Bush Jr. bought something like 10,000 acres down in Argentina.
Uh-huh.
Do you know anything about that?
I believe it was Paraguay. But... again, my research thus far has only concentrated on Argentina, because that's where chronologically the story first sort of breaks out in Latin America, but other parts of it break out later. But it's interesting that Paraguay was under the presidency of Stroessner at the time, and he was another one of these Latin American, obviously a German last name, with a big pro-Nazi sympathy. So that when Perón's government fell, Perón himself, for a period of time, went to Paraguay and began his exile. So, the rumor that the Bush family bought a ranch in Paraguay is true. But, okay, we've got 5 minutes, I see, down here left, so I'm going to have to wind this up. But that's true, that they did buy a ranch down there. Thank you.
Oh, well, good afternoon. I wish I could ask you everything I was supposed to, but I don't have the time. You don't have either. Well, years ago, I heard from a very reliable source that Hitler went to Argentina as a guest to Perón and his family. Mm-hmm. And he passed away in the 80s. Mm-hmm. And this person was from CIA.
Interesting.
A very reliable source.
Interesting.
Okay, and the other thing is that you can change time, space, vacuum. You can do that by engineering the metric of time, space, vacuum. And they did that many times, and they got all the technology from Aldebaran.
Well, I do know that the Soviet Union did a lot of this. But in terms of rationalizing where the technology comes from, as of yet, like I outlined at the beginning of the presentation, I've seen, at least as far as this material is concerned, I've seen nothing yet that makes me say that it must absolutely necessarily have come from extraterrestrials. I think that most of what the Nazis at least are doing is something that can be soundly rationalized on the basis of scientific literature.
Yeah. And now, quickly, you were talking about plasma. Mm-hmm. Have you heard about the project Vasimir, variable specific impulse magnetoplasma rocket, being developed by former astronaut Dr. Franklin Chang Diaz?
I've heard
to
of
take us to Mars?
Yeah, I've heard of NASA trying to do some work in that area, but I'm not sufficiently familiar
with it. Is it the same plasma you were talking about now?
Well, yeah, any plasma is going to operate on the same physics principles, but I'd have to look more into it to see if they're using rotation as a component. I don't know that much about the project. Okay?
Okay, thank you so much.
And we'll take what this will be our last question, then I'll have to wrap it up. Let me, before you start, ma'am, I'll be attending Jim Mars's talk, and then afterward I plan to have my booth open till about 7. So if you want to ask questions there, I'll be at, after Jim Mars gets done talking, I'll be over at my booth. Okay, go ahead, ma'am.
Unfortunately, this may not be a quick question. Mm-hmm. I do research in this field. My research and the research of my research associate, Randy Kopang, recently is very much focusing on what we call the mental interface of the technology.
Right.
It is dovetailed with the Nazi research, so we've come across that and included it in a recent article Randy's just written, that gets into their use and their knowledge of that mental component, a psi component, like a psychic function that helps in relationship to the technology. Have you come across data about the Nazis' use of that in their relationship of developing the technology?
No. Not with the Nazis. The people that I've, at least as far as I've uncovered, that start connecting this type of physics to physics of consciousness experiments and so on are the Soviets. And I do talk about some aspects of that research in the Philosopher's Stone. So there is a relationship to it, but not with the Nazis.
There's a relationship with the Nazi stuff, too. I have some information. I'll give you the article Randy recently wrote. I just was wondering if you knew more about it.
No.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, folks.